Mr. Ken Taylor, Rio One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Taylor?
Yeah, I was born in Rye, Sussex, on the 10th of June, 1923.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
My father had been a marine engineer in the Merchant Navy in World War One. My mother, he was born in Ashford in Kent. My mother was born in Whitley Bay, Northumberland. As a young girl, she was in service, as was usual in those days. During the war, she worked in munitions, as far as I know. My father left the Merchant Navy after World War One, A, because of a slump, and B, because they kept going on strike. He moved to London when I was a baby, looking for work. As I understand it, he did for a while. He was a tram driver. Then he worked as a fishmonger. He used to do the buying and also the chopping up of the fish, and also the fish frying, fish and chip shop. In 1937 or 38, he started his own radio and electrical business. And we had a radio and electrical shop. And as a youngster, one of my jobs during my lunch hour from school was delivering accumulators to people around the area.
So whereabouts were you living in London?
Edmonton, North London.
And could you... it sounds like a fairly comfortable childhood. Your father was in pretty steady employment most of the time.
Yeah. Well, I can remember once my mother, at that time I think she had the two boys, myself and my brother Bob. We had one room which backed onto the railway line at Lower Edmonton. And I think her cooker was in a cupboard on the landing, and that was our home, just one room and a cooker on the landing. Then we moved to what was known as Upper Edmonton, but we had a basement flat right by the Pimms Brook, which was a tributary of the River Lee, which was also a tributary of the Thames. And I remember my mother at the time was pregnant with my youngest brother, and the lady who lived in the flat had taken me to the pictures. And when we came back, we couldn't get down the steps to the lower flat because the gate was tied, and we found out that the flat was flooded, and there was my mother, about 8 months pregnant, trying to move furniture and save it from all the floods and the icy water. So then we got a council house near Pimms Park, 100 Park Lane. I always remember the number of that, 100 Park Lane. And
so it was quite tough at times then.
Yeah.
Now, what about your education? Tell us a bit about that.
I went to Hazelbury Road School as an infant. And then, I suppose, the equivalent
in Edmonton,
yeah, Hazelbury Road. And that was mixed, like girls and boys, because they were only primary school kiddies. Then when, I suppose, the equivalent to our 11 plus, I moved to Silver Street School, Edmonton. I took my exams to go to grammar school, but... I wanted to go to the higher grade school. There was three grammar schools. There was County School, Latimer Road School, and the higher grade. And I preferred the higher grade. And a schoolmate of mine, his brother was a prefect there, and said I actually passed the exams, but because of the intake, I was lower down the pass mark than others, so I didn't get to go to the higher grade school. I always wanted to go to sea. And in a matter of fact, my father had a motorbike and sidecar, which was one of the few people who had transport in those days. And they never dared tell me we were going to the sea because I used to mess me pants with excitement. and it was funny. In those days, they wouldn't tell me where we were going if we were going to the seaside. But when we were within 7 miles away, I could smell the sea, and it happened again. And they used to have to pull over so that I could go in the hedges, so we might say. And I loved the sea so much that even when it was cold, and they wouldn't let me swim, they had to watch me because I'd run in with all my clothes on and go straight into the sea. So I suppose it was inevitable I would join the Navy in the end.
Now, how did you? I mean, you obviously did quite well at school. Did you have any particular favourite subjects?
I don't think so. Not really.
So how did you do it?
I think if I did have, I suppose it was geography, because I used to, obviously wanted to go to sea. I was fascinated, and I always remember one geography master we had in the papers in those days. That's because in those days we had a massive merchant navy. We were all given a ship, and we had a map. And we had to, and he used to bring the newspaper in once a week, and we used to follow the route of that particular ship around the world and that sort of thing. So it was fascinating. And one of the places, I suppose, I don't know why, I always wanted to go to Java. I've never ever been to Java. It just fascinated me, some of the stories I read. Because mostly at Christmas I used to get Mum always used to make sure we had one book with our few presents as you get in those days. And it was normally a seafaring book. I remember Captain Marryat and those sort of stories.
So which secondary school did you go to?
I didn't go to a secondary school.
At all?
I left school at 14.
Did that disappoint you, or you weren't?
Well, it did at the time, obviously, you know. But then I suppose when one looks at my life, if I'd have gone to the higher grade, perhaps I wouldn't have gone in the Navy when I did. I would have gone just in as a wartime sailor, perhaps, and not as a full.
So what was your job then? You left school in, what, 1937 it would be?
1937, yeah.
And what was your first job?
My first job, well, prior to leaving school, I used to, I did a paper round. And that when you see the paper boys today, because the law was different then, I used to start my paper round at 4:30 in the morning.
Well, tell us a bit about it. What was it like in those days? You know, people, it is different now.
Yeah. Well, the paper round... the paper shop was run by two sisters who were spinsters, and they used to dress really type Victorian type. You know, they were really quaint, you saw them in their black dresses. And I used to earn extra money. I used to clean the windows for them, and they reckon I clean them better than anybody else, Leslie. So I used to get a bit of extra pocket money for that. And I always remember the first part of the paper round. I had to go up Church Street, and there was a very old church with a churchyard and almshouses. And being a youngster, churchyards used to terrify me. And it was the first part of the round, I had to go into this churchyard to deliver newspapers to the vicarage, which was a long drive up to the vicarage. And the drive went circular around a circular bed full of trees and shrubs. And I used to pedal my bike fast up there with my eyes half closed. And I remember one day going up there, and there must have been a bit of newspaper or something in the hedge, and the wind blew it, and it just lifted up. And you never see anybody drive so fast down the drive, and I threw the paper at the door, and I was out like a shot. And I also did a milk round. In those days, the milkman had a three-wheeled, solid-wheeled cart they used to push around delivering the milk. And I used to have a bicycle with a carrier on the front, and I used to deliver to all the outlying areas that he couldn't reach, you see. And I made a bit of extra money by becoming a friend with a Unigate milkman, and I used to deliver a couple of pints for him, and he used to take me into the cafe and buy me a meat pie for breakfast. That was a treat.
So when you sort of left school,
When I left school, I worked for my father. I worked in the shop, because he had the radio electrical shop in Silver Street, Edmonton. I used to charge accumulators, and that was a terrible job. And this...
What did that involve?
People used to bring their accumulators in, and we had these big chargers, and we used to have perhaps 2,000 on charge at the same time. And it involved wiring them all up with little bits of bare copper wire, removing the top so that the gas could escape when you were charging. It was a terrible job because you were breathing these fumes in all the time. My teeth had permanent brown jelly over them, and I used to clean my teeth about 5 or 6 times a day because of that to keep it clean. I used to smother my hair with Brill cream because, and I used to, my nails used to bleed, with the acid. And this had a later effect. I was instrumental to a degree in getting rid of batteries as emergency transmitters on ships, and we got them replaced with small diesels. I couldn't do it on my own because I hadn't got the power. I was a chief at the time, but I met a commander who was an electrical officer who had the same idea. And because of my anti-battery attitude,
We'll come back to that, but it's interesting that comes from your pre-war experience.
Pre-war experience, yeah.
And so you were working there as a young lad from 1937 to 1939. Anything much happened, or was it you stuck it out?
Oh, yes. Apart from Charlie Cummings, I was going with my father. He used to do accumulator charging from a large shop in Palmer's Green, which was considered in those days a more posh area than Edmonton, and they didn't want to dirty their hands with accumulator, so my father had the contract for a chap called George Watson to charge all the accumulators he collected in. Actual fact, the accumulators was bread and butter, because sales trade will go up and down. And repairs, that sort of thing, radio repairs, and this was the bread and butter, so it was a steady income. The other thing I used to do was help my father. I remember in those days, most of the houses still had gas, and we used to go around and rewire the houses for electricity, because it was all lead cable in those days, you had to be careful not to crack it. And one of my jobs was crawling under the floorboards with the wires to free. And father used to hammer away on the board to give me the direction to follow. And can you imagine the mess underneath? I remember now terraced house to completely wire it from top to bottom, from taking it from gas to electricity, was £20. We used to earn some money. My father had an amplifier and speakers, and he used to hire them out for in the park where they had a bandstand, something that they used to have dances around the bandstand, and I used to have to sort of play the records and that sort of thing, and also a woman who ran dancing classes. We used to go there, and I used to sort of play the records for that. And so, I was working sort of six days a week from 8 to 8.
Did you have much time for hobbies or sport as a youth?
My main sport all my life was swimming. I was very, very keen on swimming. And later on in Japan, I entered in the British Commonwealth swimming.
So tell us about your swimming before the war. How was a working class lad? Where did you get your opportunities?
We used to get coupons from the council, quite cheap, so you could go there every day. That was an enclosed swimming pool. And over at Winchmore Hill, they had an open-air swimming pool. We used to be able to go over there sometimes. And outside that, we used to swim in the Lee Canal. Swim in the canal. We used to dive off. I remember we used to walk from Edmonton along the canal towards Tottenham, but not right into Tottenham. And there was an old iron bridge, and we used to dive off that into the canal. And I played water polo when I was in the Navy.
Yeah. Was there any competitive swimming before the war? I mean, when you were a lad?
No, not competitive.
So it was just for enjoyment?
No, it was just for enjoyment. My competitive swimming came after I came in the Navy. Yeah.
Now, what about any other hobbies, or was that it, really?
Well, I was interested in... obviously, my father having a radio business, I was interested in radio, and I used to watch him repairing them and hold the test meter and that sort of thing. I used to get practical wireless, and I think practical mechanics or something I got as well, because I always remember there was I've got very keen on there was a model to build your own aircraft. I can't remember the name of it now. It was called the Flying Bee or Flying Flea or something, and fascinated me to think I could build this. Well, later on I found out it was a killer. It always used to crash or something. But, basically it was just... I did work with a friend of mine who used to play Hawaiian guitar in a band. And he had an ordinary Spanish guitar. And he wanted to convert it to an electronic guitar. And we experimented for months and months and months using all sorts of, chokes, wireless chokes underneath the strings, individual little coils that you get out of headphones, and that sort of thing. And we finally got this thing to work, plugged into the back of his old radiogram. The funny thing, it just matched that. You couldn't plug it into anything else. It only matched his radiogram. In August... 1938, and the second Munich crisis, It was obvious to me there was going to be a war, and I went straight down.
Now, why was it? I mean, how much did you... I mean, you were only, you're only about 15, were you?
Yeah.
How were you following what was going on in Germany? Yeah. How did you...
Dad had a radio and TV show. And funny enough, we had television, because we lived in Edmonton, and Alexander Palace was the only transmitting station at the time. And I always remember the television he had on sale in the shop was a Cossa, and it was a console model. Looked quite big, but in actual fact the screen was only a 12-inch screen, and we were quite up to date on the news there. And obviously my father was a great patriot. He was the biggest bigot you ever wished to meet. He made Alf Garnett look like the Archbishop of Canterbury. It's really true. He used to say to me as a youngster, all black men start at Cali. In other words, you're not English, you're black as far as... he was the biggest bigot going. And as in those days, you've got a lot of anti-Semitic attitudes. You know, it was called Yids, talking about, and he was one of them. You know, he was all on about bloody Yids. You know, that sort of. And my mother was the person that, you know, more or less moulded us, because she explained to me that when she was working somewhere in munitions, she was put up with a Jewish family, and she's the most lovely family going, and you know, they treated her as a daughter and everything else, you know. So my mother was the moderating influence from my father's bigotry. But he was a great patriot. This George Watson, who had this shop over in Palmer's Green, I remember it could be in 1938. We went round there to, you know, deliver his charge accumulators and collect the next lot, and he was wearing a white poppy with peace on the black button in the centre. And my father said, George, what's this? He said, you know, this peace. He said, yes. He said, want peace? And my father, I remember my father saying to him, we all want peace, George, but not at any price. He said, oh, yes. He said, I believe in peace at any price. And with that, my father's taken his jacket off and was going to thump him. And he lost the business. I remember him turning around to him. He said, if I'm the only Englishman left, he said, I shall be on the beach at Cali with a spade in my hand. He says, because no bugger's coming into my country. He said, that was my father. He was a great patriot. And in actual fact, unfortunately, he went back into the Merchant Navy as an engineer sometime at the beginning of the war, and he left my mother and he went off with some other woman. But and she had to sort of sell out the business and pay all his debts and everything else. So that was a tough time. She went through a tough time. But he went through a tough time because I met him only once through the entire war after he joined up. And he'd been a survivor about three times. He said, every time I sail out the Thames, I get sunk. He said, one of these days I'll get to sea. Like.
Now, so you were aware of what was going on in 38. Yeah. So what happened in 38? What did you decide to do?
I had a word with my mother and said, I want to join the Navy. And she said, all right, if that's what you want to do, son. She, you know, she would support you. You know, she said, I don't want to see you go, but, you know, I'll support you. And my dad was obviously okay, and I went to the recruiting office in Whitehall and joined up in August 38 when I was 15 years and 2 months old.
Is that underage?
They used to go in then, but I was there all day. It's amazing, the medical in those days, to get in the Navy, because there was so much unemployment, they could afford to be very choosy, and... the educational test was quite simple, really. It was just reading, writing, arithmetic sort of thing, you know, sort of elementary stuff. But the medical went on for hours. I mean, and it's amazing. I was a young boy there, not a muscle on me, and there was all these he-men around, and we were all stark naked, you know, being tested there. And these chaps are coming back second and third time. You know, if they had an ear infection, they wouldn't take them in. Dental... restrictions were very tight. I can't remember what it was now, but at my age, you were only allowed to have one tooth missing and no bad teeth at all. It was something like that, you know. It went on all day. It even got you on trapezes, you know, legs astride, closed, up, down, all this sort of thing. Then I was called up on February the 15th, 1939.
So there was a sort of 6 month gap. So what happened on the call up? How was the call up done? That was just the February.
I think I got a letter report to back to the White, the recruiting office in Whitehall, which didn't exist later, I know, but it was there at the time. When I got there, there was a whole bunch of us, all about sort of 15 and a half, 16, that sort of age. And the Navy always seemed to, in those days, if you were a tall bloke, you were always put in charge. they all seemed to, I suppose they seemed to think, that people would obey you if you were a big fella. And I was put in charge, given all the railway warrants and all the lads, to go to Ganges. And I was terrified all the way down that anybody would disappear and I would lose one, but as it was, they all arrived. When we arrived at Harwich, there was a chief gunnery instructor, Belton Gaiters, there on the platform to meet us. And at Ganges, there was an annex where the new recruits went in for 28 days. Where
this is Ganges, is it?
At Shotley. Yes, Shotley.
And this is the Shore Station?
Yeah, Shore Station, Boys Training
Station. Boys Training Station. Yeah. Now, tell us about, what was your reception like when you got there? Because you're arriving as you're still 15.
15 and a half.
And how did they take you in? You arrive a civilian in civilian clothes. Yeah. How did they take you in?
Oh, the first thing, when they take you in, first thing is, because you're all coming from different backgrounds, they don't know what you are, you're all given a shower and a haircut. And I remember I had nice black wavy hair, and the barber, who was an ex-Royal Marine, with great glee, shaved the lot off. And they used to more or less cut it, crop it, almost like a skinhead. With a little tuft on the front.
Did you mind?
No. The thing that amused me at the time was my father, who was a very hard man. I'm not saying he didn't love us that, but we didn't see a lot of him because when he had this job as a fish fryer, his hours were rather unusual. So mother had the job of mainly bringing up the three boys. And father was quite a strict, stern sort of chap. He gave me a pair of silverback hairbrushes in a nice case as a going away present. And when they shaved all my hair off, I thought my dad's got a sense of humour.
So the shower, haircut, what next?
And then you take your civvy clothes off, and all we had at the time, you get boots, socks, that's the bear kit they give you, and you had the old bell-bottom trousers and just the seaman's jersey with the round neck jersey. Because having had your ear shaved off and this round neck jersey, you look quite sort of scarier. Went to bed that night, and as soon as the lights went out, you could hear a lot of the boys. Some of them were crying. Others got very chatty and started talking. In comes the chief GI. On go the lights. And he said, "You obviously can't sleep. Out of bed, stand by your beds." We all got out in our pyjamas, because you had issue pyjamas. And we put our, they call them slippers, they're like a light brown shoe, which you always wore on the mess decks in Ganges, because they're highly polished decks, and you took your blaking boots off. And we were out on the playground in the dark, and I always remember him saying, "Reach for the moon," and we all looked sort of amazed. And what he meant was, hold your hands up above your head, which they, later when you got jankers, you had a rifle in it, but. And we were doubling round the parade on the first night I was in the Navy. We're doubling round and round and round the parade. And after we'd done this, for half an hour, he said, "Right, perhaps you can sleep now, back to bed." And that was the start of my life in the Navy. Because Ganges was a tough place. But it's an amazing thing. And I always think about this with today's lack of discipline amongst youngsters. The HMS Ganges, I don't go to their reunions. I keep meaning intend to, but it's a very powerful reunion. And every lad that went to Ganges is very proud of the fact they went, because it was considered the toughest training ship in the world at the time.
Now, what was your I mean, this first 28 days, what did they do with you? What were you doing the first 28 days?
Well, you get completely kitted up, because sometimes we had one lad who took about a size 14 boot, so they had a boot specially made for him. You see, so you're getting basically kitted with all your kit. You start doing.
So what was your full kit? Do you remember?
Oh yes, I mean you had two blue suits, two duck suits. You had collars, your white fronts, your jerseys, socks, boots. It was all boots in those days. Boots, pajamas, your towel, a boot cleaning gear. Towels. You're all issued with pillowcases. I don't think we had sheets then. I'm not sure. I don't think we had. I think we just had the blankets. And yeah, basically, you're doing your playground drill all the time, and you're learning how to sort of turn right, turn left, step over.
So the first 28 days was a lot of drill.
A lot of drill.
How did you take to drill? Tell me what you thought of drill.
I thought it quite good. There was a lot of shouting and bawling, a lot of bad language, as is normal on the playground, you know. But boys of that age. Are all competing against one another, and you're fit because you used to do a lot of running, running around the playground and that sort of thing. I mean, later on, you used to do cross country races.
I'll come to that. Yeah. Now, getting back to the drill, I mean, you'd never done drill before, had you? Really?
No. Well, to a degree, I was in the Boy Scouts and in the Cubs and that sort of thing when I was at school, which I failed to mention. But I enjoyed the Scouts and the Cubs and the Scouts. It was great. I took to that.
So was it? I mean, you didn't mind. Did you understand why you had to do so much drill at the time?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there was a great pride in those days. Being in the service. I mean, the Navy in those days too was considered the service. You know, people used to look up to the Navy because I mean we were renowned for. We had the largest Navy in the world, and the Navy had defended our shores for centuries, and there was great pride in being it, so you wanted to be, everybody was trying to outshine one another, really.
Now, where did you go from, what's about the barrack, when you moved out, what were the normal barracks you went into, or huts, like?
Ganges is a massive place, and they had what they called covered ways. They're all single story, and as you entered your dormitory, the first thing on your right was the washroom where you had and there was showers. They had also a place where you hung up your oilskin coat, all that sort of thing. The places got radiators around, so then you kept them warm and you got them dry. The instructors had a little office, and there was a little place for all the cleaning gear and that sort of thing. As you first go into the actual, for want of a better word, the mess deck itself.
Were they brick built or wood built?
Oh, brick built, yes.
Proper
brick built, single story. Highly polished block floors, because we used to polish them regularly. But as you first went in, the first place was where you ate. There were the dining tables and long forms. You had a couple of bogies, if I remember rightly, bogey stove. I'm not sure, I might be wrong on that. That might be in the signal school later.
Don't worry, carry on.
And there was like a dresser, for want of a better word, where because all your mugs, your plates, your pudding dishes were all like aluminium, and they were high polished on the outside as well. They were all displayed up there neatly, and then you had all the beds going all the way
now
down.
How many beds would there be roughly?
I don't know. There must have been about. It's hard to say. 40, perhaps.
And just beds, single deckers, not bunks.
It's a single decker beds.
And what were the beds like?
Iron, headboard and base and iron spring. Then you had mattresses on there.
And would you have a locker?
Yes, you all had your lockers for your kit, because you get kit musters once a month.